So we only have two lectures left, and we're going to cover a very important topic, which goes under the name of anomalies. So what is an anomaly? And so the idea is that if you just write down the tree-level Lagrangian, you write down your theory, you might have some kind of symmetry in your theory. And you're used to thinking as long as the symmetry is there at tree level, it should be preserved at loop level as well. But it's not always the case. So in certain situations, your symmetries can actually be broken through quantum mechanical effects that only arise at one loop. And there's two types of anomalies that we have to worry about. One is known as gauge anomalies. And the second one are global anomalies. And the distinction is probably clear. We have some symmetry in the Lagrangian. It's either a gauge symmetry or a global symmetry. And either one could be broken through this one loop effect. So, but they have very different implications in terms of how much you actually like the theory that you have. If you have a gauge anomaly, so this is when the local gauge symmetry, is broken. This is, we don't like this. And what do I mean by that? The reason we were motivated to write down gauge theories in the first place is we wanted to try to write down renormalizable theories so that we can make predictions at arbitrarily high energies. If the theory that you write down is secretly actually not gauge invariant after all, then you don't win. You don't gain any of the advantages of writing down a gauge theory that you started with. So it turns out that even if you start with a theory with a local gauge symmetry, if it is anomalous, the gauge symmetry is broken, and you lose all of the benefits. So people really think that if you have an anomalous gauge theory, I'm not sure people would argue with the fact that you could say the theory is pathological. But I wouldn't necessarily use such strong language. It's really just non-renormalizable. So I think, in a sense, it's OK to have an anomalous gauge theory as long as you're willing to think of it as a non-renormalizable theory. OK. But if you do want a gauge symmetry and you want the benefits of a renormalizable theory, then you want to deal with only anomaly-free theories. And again, I think this is kind of the language people use. Only anomaly-free theories are viable, but I should really not use such strong language. I should really just say renormalizable. Now, global anomalies are different. So these are not a problem theoretically. If you violate a global symmetry, that's fine. Okay, it just means that your global symmetry is not actually a symmetry, but it can be violated. And global symmetries do exist in nature. So they exist in the standard model, and they have experimental and cosmological consequences. So some examples. The accidental symmetries that we introduced For example, U1 baryon number and U1 lepton number are both actually anomalous symmetries. So even though they were accidental symmetries of the tree-level Lagrangian, those global symmetries are actually violated through an anomaly. And there's also a very famous anomaly, known as a chiral anomaly, which is relevant for the neutral pion decay into two photons. Okay, so today we're going to largely focus on just the gauge anomalies. I should say, we will focus on the gauge anomalies. And then tomorrow, we'll eventually touch upon the global anomalies. But I guess the general framework, or the general question I have in mind is we constructed the standard model as a gauge theory, and we want to make sure, first of all, that it is there are no additional things to worry about, that it is actually anomaly-free. Okay, so there's different ways of computing anomalies. I'm going to try to do the one that's perhaps the most elementary, but it's actually the ugliest. And that's in expressing anomalies in terms of Feynman diagrams. So the basic building block is a very famous Feynman diagram known as a triangle diagram. So what is this triangle diagram? Well, I'm going to compute some Feynman diagrams, and I could think of it as some matrix element. There's going to be some Lorentz indices, which I'll call nu and beta. And the Feynman diagram looks like this, and I'll explain what all of these different ingredients are in a second. So I have some fermion loop. I have some insertion here, which I'll describe in a minute. And then the fermions are going to couple to some external gauge fields, which I'll draw like this. And then this will be contracted with I times a momentum Q. So there's going to be some extra Lorentz index floating around here, and that will be contracted into Q. I'll explain what these different ingredients are. This is supposed to be a fermion loop. Okay, so I can draw some arrows. This is coupling to an external gauge field, so I can label it by some momenta P1 and a Lorentz index nu, momentum P2 and Lorentz index beta. So momentum is flowing this way. And I have also some loop momentum in the loop. So if I have K here, this would be K minus P2. This would be K plus P1, like this. And then I have another contribution, which is just the same thing, just with the lines crossed. So here I still have P1 and nu. This is P2 and beta. But now the loop momentum is slightly different. This is K. This is K minus P1. And this is K plus P2. OK, so let me go over what I mean with these different symbols. So this object here is an insertion of axial vector current. Gamma mu, gamma 5. So that object is going to be inserted here as I do this, the Dirac algebra. And then it's just contracted, this mu is just contracted into momentum Q. And this momentum Q is just the momentum conservation, just P1 plus P2. Okay. Then this vertex here is not really supposed to represent necessarily producing, you know, some U1, some gauge boson here. It's really just meant to represent an arbitrary coupling to a vector current, an arbitrary coupling to an external gauge field. So So I should, through the vector current. So what I mean by this is when I encounter this spot, as I compute this Feynman diagram, I would just introduce a factor of I times gamma mu, or whatever the appropriate Lorentz index is. And of course, my gauge field will have some gauge coupling, but I'm just going to factor that part out, and later on, I'll include it. OK. Now, these two diagrams are actually, you can see, they're related to each other, basically because I'm just swapping these two lines here. And so in practice, I can just compute this diagram here, and then this one is related to the first one just by swapping. So this is the same with P1 and nu, just swapped with P2 and beta. OK, so I'll compute one of these eventually, but from one of them, I can get the other. OK, so I'll just write down explicitly what these diagrams are. So now that I drew them, you can just use Feynman rules to compute them. So there's a fermion loop, so I have a minus 1 for the trace. I have an integral over the loop momenta, d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. I have then a trace. So I'm just going to go around the loop. I'll start at the iq. So I have iq slash gamma 5. And then I have a fermion propagator, I over k slash minus p2 slash gamma beta, I over k slash, I gamma nu, I over k slash plus p1 slash, like this, plus the same thing with p1 nu swapped with p2 beta. I should have mentioned that I want to assume that the fermions going in this loop are massless. So that's why I haven't written any mass terms here in these Dirac propagators. OK. Now, if you wanted to, the logical step would be we would try to compute this. And then we would look at the implications, but we're not going to be very logical here. What we're going to do is I just want to first write down the answer, and then we're going to discuss the implications. And then probably tomorrow, we're actually going to evaluate this. The reason is that the actual evaluation of this involves some subtleties, and it also involves a bit of algebra, and both of which are not so exciting. But I want to discuss, you know, why is it we care about this particular diagram first? What are the implications for the standard model? So you have to suspend your disbelief for the moment until Friday when we actually compute this. All right, so let me just write down the result. So you get 1 over 2 pi squared epsilon mu nu alpha beta, and then p1 mu, p2 alpha. OK, so we'll show how to get there on probably on Friday. But it's a long calculation. All right, so what we want to do is ask, you know, why do we care about this? Let's put it in the context of an actual gauge theory, and then we'll see why we wanted to compute this, and then what goes wrong now that we have this result. So here will be our model. So I'm going to assume that we have a field strength part to the Lagrangian. And then we'll have a fermion. We'll just include one fermion for simplicity. Like so. And I'm going to assume that this gauge symmetry is a chiral gauge symmetry, so that the left and right-handed components of psi transform differently. And that will prevent me from writing down a mass term for psi. So what I mean is that my covariant derivative will have different couplings to the left and right-handed projections of psi. So we have a chiral theory, provided q left is not equal to q right. And so this implies no mass terms. So we can expand the interaction part of the Lagrangian. It would look like this. I have the gauge fields coupling into psi bar gamma mu, q left, p left, plus q right, psi. And this whole object here is the current in this theory, j mu. OK. We know that due to the U1 symmetry, the current should be conserved. OK. So if that were true, we would be fine. But what we're going to show now is that it's not true, that the current conservation actually breaks down in this theory unless we make a particular choice about the charges, q left and q right. And so I want to imagine doing this calculation in the following way. Suppose we turn on an external gauge field. So we'll call this A mu external. So this is like some classical gauge field. I have, you know, I can adjust the electric and magnetic fields in the laboratory. That's what I mean by, you know, turning on the gauge fields. And so what I want to do is ask, in the presence of this external gauge field, what happens to current conservation? So I want to compute the following. D mu J mu of x. In the presence of this external gauge field. I should think of this as an operator. And so there's factors of the interaction Lagrangian implicitly in some exponential factor. And in perturbation theory, I would expand that exponential in powers of the interaction. So it turns out that in order to get, I can get something non-zero by going to second order in perturbation theory. This is order g squared. So here's what I'm computing. So I want to think of the initial and final states as being having this external gauge field turned on. So I'll write it as my state will look like this. And then this is what I'm computing. And then I have two powers of the contribution to the action from the interaction. So I would expand, and I get a half minus ig, and then some integral over space, d4y, a beta of y, j beta of y. So this was the interaction Lagrangian. And then I also have, because I'm going to second order, I want another same thing, but I just have a different spatial position here that I'm integrating over. And then this will be nu z, and then j nu of z. And then all of that will be sandwiched between my state. It's not the vacuum state because I have this external field turned on. Okay. So these are operators here, but they're really just functions of position. When they hit the external field, you'll get just the external gauge field as a function of position. So this will look like minus from the I squared. I'll have g squared over 2. I have 2 integrals over position. And then I have the external fields, beta of y, and then a nu external as a function of z. And then I have d mu x. And then left over inside of the expectation value, I have these three currents here. So I'll have j mu of x, j beta of y, and j nu of z. All right. So next, the next step I want to do is evaluate this three-point function. So it's just this object here with all of the currents. So I can expand out the currents. Looks like this. I have psi bar of x. And then I'm going to lump together the gamma and then the projectors and the charges just in some direct structure, gamma mu, psi of x. And then I have psi bar of y, gamma beta. Sorry, it should be capital gamma of beta, psi of y. And then I have psi bar of z, gamma nu, psi of z. OK, and so here I've defined, for example, gamma mu to be gamma mu, q left, p left, plus q right, p right. OK. So how do I evaluate this? Well, I can. What I want to do is just take contractions of these different fermion fields. So I can take a contraction like this, here, and then here, and then back to here. And so you see, I get from this contraction, I now have a closed fermion loop. And there's also one other contraction. So if I contracted this one with this one, I would have just a different type of contraction. That will give me the other diagram where the loop is going around the other direction. So I have plus the other contraction. And as far as the logic here, it's the same as what we just wrote down, but I just have to make a swap where y and beta go to nu and z. OK, so one contraction is easily related to the other. All right. So I want to relate what I have here to the matrix element that I wrote down above. And to do that, I want to work in momentum space. Here, everything is still a function of position. So I'm basically just going to take a lot of Fourier transforms. Space. So it's going to get a little bit ugly because we're going to Fourier transform everything. But we'll only have a couple of free momenta to worry about. And so at the end of the day, a lot of those momenta are going to simplify just using some delta functions. So we're going to Fourier transform the external gauge field. So for example, I had this object here, and I'll write that as a Fourier transform. So this thing under the integral is going to be the Fourier transform, and it'll be a function of momentum. Then I'm also going to take the Fourier transform of psi of x, psi bar of y, for example, this object here. OK, that's just the propagator, usual Dirac propagator. I know how to write down the Fourier transform of this. And for example, I'll call the momentum k1. This. So these are just two examples, but I have five things to Fourier transform. Two of these external fields I'm going to Fourier transform, and I had three propagators to transform. And so I'll have five different momenta and five different momentum integrals. So it's going to, what I'll write down will be a little bit ugly, and then it will simplify. All right, so here's what I have. So I have d mu j mu of x, and then I have g squared over 2. I'll have five momentum integrals. So I have d4 p1 over 2 pi to the fourth, external fields of p1, d4 p2, 2 pi to the fourth, external fields, Fourier transform, beta p2. Okay. Now I have this integral over still x and y. Sorry, y and z. Then I have a bunch of momentum integrals for the fermion propagators. And I had three propagators, so I have three momentum integrals. d4 k1 over 2 pi to the fourth, d4 k2 over 2 pi to the fourth, d4 k3 over 2 pi to the fourth. And then I also have this factor of a derivative here. So I'll write that in. That, just to be clear, is acting on x. Then from the Fourier transforms, I have a whole lot of exponentials of different positions and momenta. And I can group them all together, simplify it a little bit. So I have e to the minus I, k1 minus k3 dotted into x. I have e to the minus I, k2 minus k1 minus p1 dotted into y. And then e to the minus I, k3 minus k2 minus p1 dotted into z. OK, now I still have the trace, because I have this closed fermion loop. I still have the trace over the propagators in momentum space. So that will be minus 1 times the trace of gamma mu I over K1 slash I times gamma beta I over K2 slash I times gamma nu I over K3 slash. Okay. All right, so this looks all not that exciting, but it's going to simplify in a moment. Where do all of these factors of I come from? I tried to be careful with them. Hopefully I got it correct. There's I's from all of the propagators. And then there's also these I's, which came from the original interaction here. There's an I here and an I here. And those I's I wrote here as multiplying the gamma structure there. OK, and then there was a minus sign. That came from the I squared, which was what I wrote here. OK, so now let's simplify it. So first of all, let's define Q to be P1 plus P2. And then also K, I'll define to be K2. Now, when we do this integral over position here, dy and dz, I'll get momentum conservation. So this one, this combination of momenta will be conserved. This combination of momenta will be conserved. d4y, d4z. This implies momentum conservation. So we have k1 is now equal to k2 minus p2, which is now, according to my definitions, I'm just removing the 2 here. This k will be the leftover loop momentum integral. So this will be k minus p2. And then I also have k3. Is k2 plus p1, and so this is k plus p1. And the other thing is that if I have k1 minus k3, which is what's appearing here, this is now just minus q. So now my derivative just acts on this exponential. It will just get I times Q. So d mu x will go to I times Q mu. OK. So now it simplifies a bit. So here's what I have. So I have g squared over 2. I still have these integrals over p1 and p2. I have the external fields in Fourier space. Have e to the I q dot x. And then I have minus 1 times one more integral over momenta. I removed 2 of them out of the 3, and I still have 1 left over. Trace of I times q slash q left p left plus q right p right. I over k slash minus p2 slash I times gamma beta q left plus q right I over k slash times I gamma nu q left plus q right and then I over k slash plus p1 slash. Okay. Plus the other contraction. Which is just P1 nu swapped with P2 and beta. All right, so all of the stuff on the second line is almost exactly what I had wrote down before as this basic building block, this triangle diagram. But it's not quite the same. What I wanted was something which was Q slash gamma 5. Okay, propagator, and then the vector current insertion, so just a gamma mu, or a gamma beta in this case, without all of this stuff. Another propagator, another gamma matrix, and then again without all of this stuff. So I need to manipulate it a little bit more just to make it look exactly like what I had before. And it's straightforward, yeah.
Sorry, how did you do the other two momentum integrals?
So I did them using energy momentum conservation.
Sorry, they give you delta of this.
Yeah, so these will give you delta of this and delta of that.
Sorry.
So I need to manipulate this expression a little bit more to make it look exactly like this matrix element that I wrote down to begin with. And it's easy to see what you want to do. You want to get something with a gamma 5 here and no gamma 5s or projectors over here. And so I'm just going to take these factors and move them through. Each time I move it through one of these gamma matrices, and you should think of the propagator itself as a gamma matrix, of course, you'll flip left and right. So here I'll have left going to right to left, so it will pair up with this, to right to left, and then it pairs up with this. And so the left-handed ones will all combine together to give me Q left cubed, and the right-handed ones will all combine together to give me Q right cubed. Okay, so I'm imagining moving the Qs all the way through, so they're all bunched up together to the right of the Q slash. So I'll have, for example, a term like Q slash, Q left cubed, P left plus Q right cubed, P right. All right, now it turns out that I only need to worry about the part with the gamma 5. That's the one that I started with. So I'm not going to include the term which is like proportional to the 1 of these propagators here. That will give us a contribution that will vanish, although I'm not going to show that that's true. We only need the gamma 5 parts. And so I'm just going to replace this by Q slash, and then I'll have Q right cubed minus Q left cubed over 2, and then times gamma 5. So only the gamma 5 term will give a non-vanishing contribution. Okay, so now this factor in parentheses is just a number. There's no more projectors. And so I can use that to write this what I have above in exactly the form that we had started out with. Okay, so what do we have? We have g mu d mu of x is now, I still have g squared over 2. Now I have a factor of q right cubed minus q left cubed over 2. I still have these integrals over p1 and p2. have an e to the I q dot x. And then I have minus one loop momentum. And then the trace of I q slash gamma 5 I over k slash minus p2 slash I gamma beta I over k slash I gamma nu I over k slash plus p1 slash. And all of this is plus the other contraction as well. Where I swap p1 and nu with p2 and beta. Okay? All right, so after all of this, I was very careful, so that now what's on the second line here is exactly the matrix element that we started with. So it's actually including both contractions. So this is this I m nu beta that I wrote down before. And although I haven't actually evaluated it, I will continue just by writing down the answer that I wrote down above. So this whole thing is just 1 over 2 pi squared epsilon mu nu alpha beta p1 mu p2 alpha. Okay, so we're almost done, actually. What we can do is we're going to now go back to position space. And so I want to write these momenta now as derivatives. So I have, for example, p1 mu, and then this exponential factor of e to the I p1 x. Let me write it like this. So I have p1 mu p2 alpha times this these exponential factors, e to the I p1 x, e to the I p2 dot x. And I can rewrite these momenta just as derivatives. So I should have minus I squared d mu x, and then I'm getting a little bit confused. Yeah, okay, let me try to not do both terms at once. All right. So let me separate out the two integrals over p1 and p2. Let's consider just the p1 term. So I have factor of p1 mu, and then a nu external as a function of p1. And then I have e to the I p1 dotted into x. All right? So I can use integration by part. So I can first write this as a derivative with respect to x, and then use integration by parts to move. Actually, do I need to use integration by parts? I don't think I do. So I have d4p1. I can just write this as a derivative, minus I d mu of x acting on the external field in Fourier space, I p1 dot x. And so now this whole thing, I can go back to position space, and it's just the external field as a function of x. And so this is just minus I external fields nu p mu as a function of x. Okay? And I can do that for both of these terms. And that will allow me to get rid of those momentum integrals. And then I get the following. Mu j mu of x is equal to g squared over 2. I have q right squared minus, q left squared minus q right squared over 2. Cubed. And then I have this factor of 1 over 2 pi squared. And then you can see here I have a derivative and acting on an external gauge field. But then the whole thing is anti-symmetrized because of this Levi-Civita tensor. And so I can write that in terms of the field strength tensor. So I have this anti-symmetric tensor, epsilon mu nu, alpha beta. I have d mu a external nu, d alpha a external beta. And this whole object here, I can write as a quarter epsilon mu nu alpha beta f mu nu external f alpha beta external. OK? So now I can combine all of these numerical factors and write it in a more simplified form. So I have just q left cubed minus q right cubed. I have g squared over 32 pi squared, epsilon mu nu alpha beta, and then f mu nu external, f alpha beta external. Okay, so this is it. As long as this is true, and we'll show it tomorrow, the current is now no longer conserved in this theory at one loop. It depends. If we turn on an external gauge field, we effectively have a source for charge. We were careful about how to set up the problem in terms of this external field that we turned on. But typically, you would abbreviate this formula here in the following way. D mu j mu would be equal to q left cubed minus q right cubed g squared over 32 pi squared epsilon mu nu alpha beta f mu nu f alpha beta. This is a way to just abbreviate it. All right. All right, so why is this weird? Well, we want to ask, what type of field would you have to turn on in order to generate some charge? So if we have this external field, we want to make sure this combination is non-zero. So this combination of fields is just equal to minus 8 times the electric field dotted into the magnetic fields. OK? So now I can think about, if I did turn on this field, so imagine adjusting the electric and magnetic fields in your laboratory. You just make them parallel to each other. This would act as a source of charge. So let me write the charge as little q. And what I mean by this is just an integral over the charge density, spatial integral over the charge density. And I want to imagine that the integral is over all space, so I'm computing the total charge. So now, if I want to calculate how much charge gets produced by my external field, I want to compute dq by dt. And so this is an integral d3x of dj0 by dt. And as long as I'm integrating over all space, I can just rewrite this as an integral over d mu j mu. Because the spatial part of this represents current flowing to infinity, as long as infinity is infinitely far away, then I can throw that part out. Okay, and now I can use this rule here, and it is now equal to minus g squared over 4 pi squared q left cubed minus q right cubed, and then I have this integral over e dotted into b. Okay, so it would be a weird thing if in your laboratory you made the electric and magnetic fields parallel to each other and you started producing electrons. All right, so that's problematic. Okay, so what we've shown is that the Ward identity is violated. Ward identity is related to current conservation. The Ward identity was also a consequence of gauge invariance. And so now we also have gauge invariance. The gauge symmetry is violated. Even though it's a little bit obscure what effect this has, everything that can go wrong does go wrong in terms of having gauge symmetries that are broken or that are violated. For example, you generate a non-zero gauge boson mass. And that comes from these triangle diagrams. For example, if I'm imagining the propagator for this gauge boson, I could sandwich two triangle diagrams together, and this particular thing will generate a mass for the gauge field. Okay, once I have a mass for my gauge field, we know that the theory no longer becomes renormalizable. So it's a non-renormalizable theory. Okay, so what this tells us is that in order, if we really want to have a gauge, a renormalizable gauge theory, we want to make sure that these anomalies vanish. The only way to prevent the anomalies from appearing is if this overall coefficient in front of this term vanishes. So we need to have the charges chosen in a specific way so that the anomaly vanishes. So what we do is we want gauge anomalies vanish in a renormalizable theory. So far, we only have had one flavor of fermion. So this is the case of if you have one flavor, there's only one way to satisfy that equation. You need to have q left equal to q right. Okay, so the charges of the two chiralities must be the same. Of course, that's what happens in QED. The electron has the same coupling to the photon for both left and right-handed components. And so we're glad to find out that QED is anomaly-free. Okay, so that is good. Now, what we want to do is, we want to ask, does this problem arise in the standard model? And, well, the gauge theory that we wrote down is not the standard model. We only had one fermium. And so now we need to generalize this calculation.
We want to ask
two ways. And the first way is just simply we want to introduce multiple fermion species. So now we'll have left and right-handed chirality fields, but I should label them by some other index I, which labels which fermion we're talking about. Are we talking about quarks or leptons, and which type of quarks or leptons? OK, so here I is the flavor or type of fermion. And each one will have its own charges. So I can think of left and right being different for all of the different fermions. Okay, so it's easy to see how this will generalize based on what we did. Instead of having just one fermion in the loop, now we have many fermions in the loop. So we just need to sum over all of the different possibilities of fermions in the loop. So now I can generalize this calculation. So I still have g squared over 32 pi squared. But now I'm just summing over I. So I'll have q left I cubed plus q right I cubed. And then epsilon mu nu alpha beta f mu nu f alpha beta. And OK, this is very important to get the sign right here. OK, so this is a kind of a straightforward generalization. Already, we can apply it to the standard model because we have a U1, which has chiral interactions in the standard model, hypercharge. So we can basically just write down what the rule for hypercharge is. Let's apply this to hypercharge. U1y. OK, so I want to calculate this hypercharge current. So my g is now g prime. And I have the sum over the hypercharges. So I'll write this in the following way. In the standard model, well, in this discussion, I really framed it as we had these individual species, Dirac fermions, effectively, and they had different couplings for the left and right-handed components. In the standard model, we really separate them out, left and right-handed components. So I'll write the sum like this. Let's sum over the left-handed fermions here. We want to write down the hypercharges for those left-handed fermions. Minus a sum over the right-handed fermions. have right-handed hyperchargers, cubed. And then we have epsilon mu nu, alpha beta, and then the field strength tensor, which you write using B for hypercharge. Okay, so in order to not violate the gauge symmetry, we need this factor in parentheses to vanish. And so we have a constraint on the allowed values of the hypercharge. They have to satisfy this equation here. So we must have the sum equals zero. All right. Now, I want to be clear here. For example, if I want to talk about the hypercharge for the left-handed quark doublet, this would be a 6. The hypercharge for the right-handed up-type quark is 2/3, etc. Okay, so you plug in a 6 over here and the 2/3 over there. Now, you also have to remember one other point, which is that when we sum over all of the fermions on the loop, we have to also include all of the other degrees of freedom that each field has. And so we must also sum over all of the color and SU2 left degrees of freedom. So for this case, I would have 3 colors and 2 components to the SU2 left. For SU2 left, and so that would be 3 × 2 degrees of freedom. And here I just have 3 degrees of freedom, for example. Okay? So if you wanted to check that this is true, I just want to make these clarifications. So this is a constraint. There's some notation. Remember, I calculated this expectation value of 3 currents. In this particular case, all of those currents come from hypercharge. So I have a constraint from 3 hypercharge current insertions. And so that's typically denoted as U1y cubed. So it's just some notation that this condition, for this condition. So here I have one equation here. OK. Now, the other way that we have to generalize the calculation for the standard model is we can have mixed anomalies. In the standard model, we don't just have a U1, but we have 2 other gauge groups as well. And so we have to show how this anomaly relationship works for non-abelian theories. So we'll start with that tomorrow.